All right, guys, so the much-awaited podcast with Scott Young is here. A lot of interesting stuff on how you can hack your learning, learn faster, more efficiently. He's got tips on how you can be your most optimal self. And after we get done talking about all of that, I get him to speculate on what's coming up in the future of learning. Are we going to hook our brains up to the internet? Will we even need to learn languages anymore? And of course, we solve the question of whether there are aliens or not. So tons of stuff here. Make sure to subscribe to the 11th Commandment YouTube channel to watch short clips and the video versions of all of our podcasts, and subscribe to Golarami on YouTube and Instagram. And we will love you forever if you can leave us a good review on iTunes. And with that, enjoy the podcast.
The Way of Will John.
We have been wanting to do this podcast for probably what seems like 8 years now. We have the lovely Scott Young. Scott, what's up, man?
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. So listen, yeah, like we said, guys, we've had all sorts of issues and everybody knows what's going on in the world right now. Yeah. And it's just good to finally get you on because there's just so much we could probably talk about considering, you know, before I dig into all the things that are selfishly I just want to talk about, we should let you say who you are, what's up, you kind of what's going on. I've prefaced you plenty of times because we've been trying to have this podcast. So I'm always like, hey, guys, Scott Young coming on the podcast next and then it doesn't happen.
Wow. Well, I'm really flattered by that. Yeah. Well, I'm a blogger. I write at my blog, scotthyoung.com. I've written there for, I want to say 14 years now. I think that's right. 14 years sounds about right. And one of the things that maybe some people kind of know me a bit for is doing learning projects. So I did a project called the MIT Challenge now about 9 years ago, which was to try to learn MIT's four-year computer science curriculum in 12 months. But instead of going to MIT and taking classes and spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in tuition, I just tried to use their free material that they posted online to try to create some kind of facsimile or some sort of benchmark of their curriculum to teach myself. And then I did another project a couple years after that with a friend, and I called it The Year Without English. And we traveled to four countries and learned Spanish, Portuguese, Mandarin, Chinese, and Korean. And the kind of crux of that project was that we tried our very best not to speak English the entire year, not only to each other, but to anyone that we would meet. So we would have that kind of total immersion. And I've also done projects to learn things like portrait drawing and quantum mechanics and all sorts of things on my blog. And I've recently published in August, I published a book kind of documenting not only some of my projects, but people who have, I think, much more impressive stories than my own, called Ultra Learning. And it's about how you can do the same kind of thing. If you wanted to learn interesting, hard skills for your life that matter, and you want to know an effective way of doing it, this book is how to do that.
Yeah. So, I mean, to top all that off, I discovered you back in the MIT Challenge days. It has been,
yeah,
that's
so like
been
8 or 9 years ago. Yeah. Wow.
It's insane.
I'm feeling old right now.
did you have the email list back then? Like, is that when
Yeah, I think I got, I don't know, because I've been blogging for so long that that was back when people did RSS. And RSS is like, what is that now, right? But that was the thing people were doing. And I did get an email list. So it would have been around that time that I would have been sending out an email newsletter.
It was forever ago. I had to join it with I joined your email list like with my scientific calculator or something. Like it was way back.
Yeah, MSN Hotmail account, you know.
Totally. Yeah. But in looking at what you were doing now, it's interesting. I don't know how new, and you're obviously always moving on to new things. When I saw you, first off, computer science doing the MIT challenge, that's an insane thing to do. Obviously, it struck me as I have a huge interest in languages, you know, and in learning. And I've talked about, and I think it was in the very first podcast where I went on a rant on my academic advisor at my college, who I got there and I was a biology major. And obviously I went to school on a soccer scholarship. And I knew I was going to play soccer. By the time I was 19, I went pro, and I knew that. I got to college at 18 and I knew I was going to go pro. And I mean, there were no guarantees, but it was just what I felt internally.
Yeah.
And she told me I wasn't allowed to study Italian and Spanish at the same time. And I had a fit.
Yeah.
So I instead, and at the same time in the meeting, I also told her that I wasn't going to stay in school. Yeah. And she didn't understand any of this. You know, it's her job to make sure I do well. But so I studied Italian during math, during algebra, because I didn't like it then. But when I saw you doing computer science, and now you're doing quantum mechanics, I was thinking, where are we going? What is Scott going to be doing in 15 years? So what's up now? Like, what is this now? What's the next thing?
Oh, wow. Well, I think that's a really interesting question, because I feel like my own sort of the kind of projects that interest me and what I'm drawn to has been shifting as well, because, you know, it's when I was doing the MIT Challenge, I was like right out of school. And so I think that was sort of a very natural project for me to pick, because, you know, up till that point, I'd basically been my whole life, I'd been in school, and this kind of idea of thinking around school had been really how I'd structured a lot of my thinking about, well, how do you learn things? Well, you learn them in school. And I would say that how I've shifted since then is I've become a lot more interested not only in learning skills. And I think I've, from going through a lot of the research, sort of come to realize how much schools often do a disservice to people who want to acquire skills to be able to do things. And we can go into some of the research on that later, but I think it's kind of interesting, because the assumption is, well, you know, obviously the best schools in the world, they're teaching it the best way. And that may not be true, or it may not even be the case that they're teaching what they're trying to teach in the wrong way, but that their goals for education are maybe not what yours might be when you're attending the school. And so that's very important to keep in mind. And then the other thing that I think is sort of interesting that has sort of shifted in my perspective as well is just the idea that there's so many things that you can learn and do that don't really fit into those standard, you know, this is a certain set of classes or this is a certain set of things. And so really there's lots of things that we want to do in life that, you know, it's strange, there's no class for that, but you maybe want to get good at it. Maybe you want to become a good writer, or you want to be a better communicator, or you want to do lots of things better in your life. And these are learning projects. They just kind of don't look like school projects.
Right. Well, this is, it's one of the interesting things. And this really is, and should be my first question, because everybody that's listening here, the majority of them is, you know, they're young guys all the way up to guys in their 40s, you know, and, everybody, that's the time in a guy's life and girls, you know, where you want to sort shit out. You want to figure out how to do this thing as quick as you can, as best as you can, to benefit you, to benefit your family, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I haven't finished ultra learning. I'm loving it, by the way. And I know, so I've been trying to, Benny and I have also been trying to figure out when we're going to have this, talking. He's, you know, his email, he's notoriously.
He's a great guy.
Yeah. No, he truly is. He's one of the other guys that I honestly probably discovered around the same time. I think he was starting his upswing. I was, you know, when you're in that polyglot world, you kind of find certain things early on. But for the guys that want to learn, and I have two questions. The first one being, could you give these guys that are obviously kids are at home, you know, and people are at home now, but first off, could you kind of explain the idea, the thesis behind ultra learning, behind trying to learn something quicker as you found it, someone who's done this so many times? And then I would love to, if we could, because I haven't seen this yet, and maybe you do touch on it, but adapting that to sports, adapting that, does that mean, you know, does that mean do I need to learn how can I learn how to get faster? So
So I guess the basic idea of ultra learning and sort of how I define it in the book, after I kind of give a lot of stories of people who are doing these kinds of projects, just sort of see what the examples are. But I think the definition is people who take on aggressive self-directed learning projects. And so what that means is that the self-directed part is in contrast to the way that we normally think about education, where there's a teacher or a school or an institution telling you what to do and you just kind of follow along. Whereas a self-directed project is, what do I want to learn? How do I want to learn it? What's the best way to do it? And you're making those choices. Now, maybe those choices are going to lead you to find a mentor or a school or a class. So it's not to say that it's, you know, you have to lock yourself away from everyone else in society, even though a lot of people are doing that involuntarily right now. But it isn't to say that you have to do it that way. If you like learning in groups of other people, if you learn best socially, that's fine. The point of it is that you are the one sort of driving the car, so to speak. You're the one who's making the decisions. And the aggressive aspect of it is that the people that I documented who do this are really, really interested in what is the most effective way to learn something. And there's a very common theme among many of the different areas of learning that I've uncovered in some of the scientific research, where the thing that's more effective for learning is harder and it's not the default. So give an example of that. One of the ways students study things is they just read things over and over again. And that is, it's time consuming and it's kind of boring, but it's not that hard to do. Whereas we know from lots of research that if you close the book and try to just recall from memory everything that was in there without looking at it, you'll do much better on later tests. But that's also hard to do. It's something you can be wrong at, you can find frustrating, you can fail at. And so one of the themes of this sort of aggressive learning isn't, you know, spend 60 hours a week, but rather make very careful decisions about how you're going to spend your time, and often doing things that, yeah, maybe you can't also do that with the TV in the background and, you know, half asleep and this kind of thing. You do actually have to focus, you do have to work hard, but the results are worth it. And so I try to make that case in my book that if you really wanted to get good at something, whether it was public speaking, whether it was school, whether it was something for your work, this is the kind of approach that you should take to do that effectively and efficiently. And then, you know, when you do it efficiently, that also ends up becoming faster than doing it the normal way.
Yeah, that is, yeah. Because I've adapted my own style of learning, and it's something, it's like a hybrid fashion of as I'm reading and understanding your methods, you know, and the methodology behind the way you're describing how we should learn. I'm noticing that in stumbling, in failing along the way, because I'm at 8 languages, you know,
yeah.
And that's, it was a goal of mine at 16 to reach 10, you know, and I can clearly do that. I can definitely do that. Now, maintaining and retention and stuff like that, that's a whole nother game, which, you know, we can maybe get into, because I'm definitely curious, you know, how you're able to maintain these skills, how you set things up, because not everybody wants to just do one skill and say, all right, I'm good, you know. It would be awesome, though, if that was the way things worked. Where was I going on this? Look at me. I've lost my entire...
Well, we were talking about sports. That was one of the points you wanted to talk about.
Well, yeah, I wanted to go into sports. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to, when you mentioned talking about having to turn off the TV and doing those things, I do know my point. My point was I stumbled onto this aggressive learning style.
Yeah.
I stumbled into... because I took high school Spanish, and... Mm-hmm. Nobody I took high school Spanish with speaks Spanish. Of course they don't. They spend all their time in the books. How the hell are you going to learn Spanish? Never speaking Spanish. Does that make sense?
I want to interject to the point here, because I think this is really good. Because sometimes when I talk about learning faster with, you know, when I'm saying you can learn faster. And then sometimes there's the person who's the skeptic. There's the person who's kind of like, oh, what's this learning faster? What's this guy talking about this and that? But to me, I think the point to understand is not so much that it's learning faster in the sense of like, oh, your brain is just going 400 times the speed or something like that. Rather, it's just to recognize how bad we are at learning most of the time. And I think the Spanish classroom example, it just shows this so clearly. So for my example, I didn't take high school Spanish, but I remember this was before I went to live in France for a year, and I was really interested in learning French. And so I thought, naturally, I'm going to go talk to everyone who went on exchange. And we're not even talking about taking just a regular class that you did once a week. I'm talking about you went and lived in that country for 4 months, a year. And I went and I asked these people, and I said, how many of you came back being able to speak the language from the country you went to? And there was a big group, about 30 people, who were from like the cohort the year before me. And I went and I talked to them, and none of them could do it. And so I think the point I'm trying to put across, what I'm saying about like learning faster and more effectively, is to realize just kind of how bad the status quo is for many subjects and many ways that we learn things. And so my point isn't to kind of be selling some kind of miracle cure that you're going to unlock 400% more of your brain. It's not like that at all. Rather, what it is just recognizing that actually a normal person could learn a language that's, you know, especially if it's in a similar language family to the one they already speak, could probably learn that in 3 to 6 months to a level where they could, you know, get by in daily life only using that language. And that's just something I think everyone could do if they did it the right way. But almost nobody does it the right way, which is why we have this sort of situation. So anyways, that was just my little interjection for anyone who's is sitting there skeptically on the sidelines.
Right, I see that. I'm sure. I mean, you probably get clearly, you know, questions and things like that. And as society is the way it is now, anyone claiming that they can improve something so incredibly important as learning faster or quicker. But yeah, it is the truth that the way that I was studying originally, maybe whether it was writing things down or studying charts and tables, by the time I got to German, I knew to just say to hell with learning the grammar at the beginning. I was so, and having done that and sticking myself aggressively into conversations, into reading, into, you know, using those things. Yeah. And then one of the biggest things I have, and maybe you can tell me if this is true, because I stumbled onto this. Actually, it was something that I started to do when I moved to Denmark. I played in Denmark, which was strange just in and of itself, as when I got there, we were fairly well split of a team, a lot of foreigners and a lot of Danish guys, but many of the foreigners coming from Africa and Brazil didn't speak any English at all. And so what the director of the team did is get them a English tutor. And I already spoke English, obviously. And I told him I wanted to learn Danish. And he goes, why? He goes, we speak English as good as you. And I'm thinking, well, it'd be awesome. You know, let me figure it out. But in any case, what I found when approaching a language, and I know there's tons of theories and tons of ideas out there, but learning these key phrases and words that will allow me to immediately engage someone, allow me to put myself in these situations. And I guess it's kind of, and you speak of something on this in Ultra Learning, when you try to understand why it is that you want to use, or why it is that you want to learn the thing that you're learning. You know, there's no point for me to go study a book on rocket science in Chinese when I need to know how to say, give me some food, please. I'm hungry, you know? And so there are all sorts of ways to do that, all of which were not taught to me at all in school. Not even once. Why? I don't understand, you know?
But, well, you know, I think, so maybe I'll rephrase it a little bit, because this is how I see this point, is that a lot of us think of subjects and the way that they're presented in school is these sort of inert little bodies of facts and concepts that you need to pass certain tests in a classroom. And maybe for some subjects, that's actually what they are. Like, you're not actually ever going to encounter those subjects in the real world. But I think that's a real shame, because if you believe in, you know, that learning things matters, as I do, then this is really worrying, because what it's essentially saying is that you're learning kind of these rituals almost that apply in this one scenario that you're never going to use somewhere else. So I think the mistake to think of language learning, the mistake is thinking of it as vocabulary and grammar and pronunciation that you need to master. And then one day you'll eventually start using it to communicate, and rather think that what a language is fundamentally is communication. And so that might change for you. So for some people, that's going to really be about having conversations. And then obviously, if I'm learning like Latin, I'm not going to be using that to have conversations. Maybe it's to read books or something. But in other words, it's still about communicating. It's still about getting information from some source to another source that I actually care about, that's related to me meaningfully. And so I think the obstacle is that the real communication situations you care about are often, they feel overwhelming. They're like, this is impossible. I can't even do anything here. And so we sort of slink back to this kind of academic task of, well, just keep acquiring phrases and vocabulary and words, and eventually you'll be able to do some communicating. And so I think from the people that I've studied that do learn languages well, the thing that they tend to do well is find a way to bridge into actually using the language to communicate, and using that as a basis point for, you know, there's nothing wrong with acquiring words and phrases and vocabulary, but there's a big difference between I'm learning this phrase because I need to use it to get something done versus there's another thing that I've memorized and, you know, maybe it'll come in handy one day.
Yeah, no, totally. What I think is also interesting, I did do that at one point. I did stumble into trying to just learn phrases, And then you notice you never use that. I never learned. Yeah. I never needed to say, can I get the cat off of the ladder? I didn't need it. It just didn't come up. So, but you know, in transitioning into sport, how could one use this and learn this in sport? Because the way I see it is I now know my body so well, you know, compared to, and it was, yes, it was through a lot of failing, but as I've gotten older and understood how to be more efficient with my training and with things like that, there are a whole lot of exercises and things that I know I don't need to do, not because I don't think that they're good for other people. And I do teach them. We do teach them on the channel. It's because I know what's good for me. I know the things that will get me the most efficient training and the most, you know, bang for my buck. And those, by the way, they tend to be the Olympic lifts. And I don't do those. Do you know what the Olympic lifts are?
So like the clean jerk and the
pull, squat, front squat, those sort of things, you know, because they're these complex, you know, motions and movements. And I don't just train, you know, my quad. I don't just, yes, you can do that. Yes, there are ways to stabilize the knee, et cetera, et cetera. I could go on all day. You know, I do love that stuff. But everybody has to kind of look at themselves, and I'll even make it a bit more stringent and constrict us to soccer. Everybody looks at themselves as this little, you're a little project that you have to understand all these things. And even if you're not a soccer guy, it doesn't matter. I don't know if you know anything about soccer, but we have to, you, on the field, you have to understand, okay, do I need to learn how to run faster? Do I need how to learn how to get stronger? Do I need to know how to jump? Do I need to learn how to hold off a person? And so within each attribute that a player has is an entire world of exercises and ways for you to get better at them. Of course, players don't have any idea how to do that if they don't have any guidance. And most of the people that are coming to the channel are looking for someone to just make that easier for them. And, you know, and so maybe you have an idea of what you would do if you need to learn. I would say two things about sports.
So one feeling that I have about sports is that athletics is one of the domains where I think we understand learning best, in the sense that the way that it proceeds typically is that players interact with a coach who sort of breaks down what they're doing and offers sort of strategic advice and stuff. So when I look at like the best athletics programs, I'm thinking that these are kind of people doing almost the best that you can do with learning in that regard. And, you know, if we're going to look at a spectrum from like typical high school Spanish class to like elite level athletics program, that would be the spectrum I'd be looking at. Now, the challenge is that often a lot of people don't have access to, you know, an elite level athletics program. They have to do these things themselves. And so if you, you know, have a really great coach and they can tell you, okay, you're doing this wrong and you need to work on this and do those kinds of drills and work on this, that's probably the right way to proceed. Or at least if there's a better way of proceeding, I don't know what it is. But on the other hand, I think one of the challenges is, how do you create that environment for yourself if maybe you don't have access to the level of coaching or you don't have access to that level of things? So I think there's still a lot of interesting things that people can do under those constraints. So even things, you know, like people, you know, video recording themselves or tracking metrics for feedback and getting these kinds of information. There's a lot more things that you can get access to now and record about yourself and get this information to sort of fine tune where you're going to invest your effort, where you're going to invest your energy and stuff. And so I think that just even, you know, the casual player who wants to be better at his game can apply a lot of these same tools to enhance it, even if they don't have access to like Olympic level coaching and stuff.
Right. Yeah. I think because part of the issue in that goes on in America and clearly in other places, because we get a lot of these questions, is that the coach will just say, not good enough. Well, what wasn't good enough, coach? I don't understand. Are you not playing well? Well, I got to figure out a way to analyze this. Is that because I'm not fast enough? Do I need to figure that stuff out? So, but anyway, just to bring it back, I do have two questions, because who is coming up actually after you in the podcast world, I interviewed Ed Hawkins, who has been a journalist for 23, 24, 25 years. What he ended up doing was he wondered, if people are going to, if so much money is involved in sports in general, and what he does also, he splits his time between also anti-corruption. So he's got all these interesting stories about, you know, people trying to break the laws, you know, of the game and stuff like that. But what he wrote a book on, essentially trying to get to the top upper 1% of sport. What is it that they're trying? And what he uncovered, you know, was that a lot of it had to do with the mind, and a lot of it had to do obviously with the flow state and et cetera and things like that. But the book was incredibly interesting as it tried to convey to people the ways for them to get into the flow state, things like that they needed to have reduced stress in order to do that. You have to want to win, but you can't want to win at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, what sort of environment will create the optimal level for you, not just to get better, but to learn and train better as well. And so it was really fascinating to learn. But the reason I kind of bring that up is because everybody knows and feels that you're not doing your best in a certain way. And I mean, I don't mean to say that we should all, you know, be terribly hard on ourselves, but we all feel as if we have a little bit more to give. And so that's what pushes most athletes and most people that want to learn, is that they know, I can do that better. Let me analyze this. Let me get to be a little bit better. And having the TV on is another. I obviously love deep work. Cal Newport is that totally changed me as well. Even though sometimes when I think about it, it's like, well, of course, if you keep checking your email, you're not going to get better at learning.
Like, and yet, you know. And yet we do, right? I agree with you. You know, I think a lot of people, see, this is the way I would phrase it too, is that it's not the case that every single person has the same problem. It's not the case that, well, if you just, everyone just does this one thing, then that will fix it. The way that I would think about it, and I think especially in the sports context where we do have a fairly good, you know, it's not like the status quo model for how people learn sports is so bad that, you know, it's, if you're sort of, if you have a coach and they're, you know, they know something about body movements and this kind of thing, they can help you out a lot. But I think the right way to think about it is that if you understand the learning process and you have some sense of kind of, well, what are the ingredients that have to go into successfully learning something, then that allows you to diagnose mistakes that you're making. Now, the mistake you're making might not be the mistake that someone else is making on your team or some other person is making. I mean, we can talk about the language learning example where kind of systematically schools tend to remove it from the communication context and this creates some issues. But there's also lots of situations where maybe the problem one person has is that they're, you know, not actually practicing this in the right way. So they're not actually making the movements they're having are not getting kind of done perfectly. And so that they're kind of screwing them up when they're doing it. For other people, maybe they have big weaknesses that they haven't filled in and they haven't been able to analyze it. And so I think that the more you understand the learning process, the more you can bring those kind of tools to bear to analyze your own performance. So what you were saying is absolutely right. We all feel like there's more we could do. And I think the more you understand kind of what's going on in the background, the better you are able to do that.
Totally. And one of the things that I actually wanted to touch on in leading over from Ed's book as well is, what about some of these, because you see these things and I've never tried any of them truly, you know, but my question is, what about trying to actually get smarter or get more efficient in those ways? Say brain, people know that Sudoku can do certain things, but it doesn't help your IQ. Maybe it doesn't help. There's all sorts of ideas and things like that. Do you have a take on that? Do you ever do anything to actually try and increase your ability to, you know?
Well, so I think I would say that in sort of two ways. So one way I think is that there's lots of things that we know that probably reduce your mental performance. You know, not getting enough sleep is a huge one. You know, if you're not getting enough sleep, that impacts memory consolidation, which is going to make it really hard for you to perform well in exams. We know, you know, obviously certain substances that you're taking are going to impact your mental performance. There's other sort of factors, like for instance, just exercising, right? So if you're exercising regularly, you're going to have better cognitive performance than if you don't. And so there's a lot of things that, like, if you don't do that thing that it kind of makes sense that you should do, you're going to have lower performance. So I think there is a general sense that most of us are not reaching that ideal. So if you're not reaching that ideal in terms of taking care of your body, taking care of your mind, taking care of that sort of basic platform, not only your sort of physical body, but also your mental, emotional life, this kind of thing. If those aren't sort of in tip-top shape, then there is probably things you could do to improve yourself. Anxiety is a big thing. You know, if you're anxious all the time, that's going to be really hard to study and perform well. So if you can take things that will reduce your anxiety, that will help you. So I think the fact that very few of us live to that ideal of perfection means that, yes, there are things that we can do. Now, are there things that, let's say you're a healthy, you know, not anxious person, you're doing well, are there things that you can do that will make you much, much smarter? And this, I think, is an area that I've actually shifted my views on a little bit, because I used to kind of not make a really sharp distinction between learning and intelligence, because obviously if you learn things, you're smarter, right? And so there's just kind of a general sense that that's true. If you just know more things, you're a smarter person. Now, from exploring more of the research, the thing that I think that I've understood a little bit better now is that when we learn things, they tend to be more specific. So it isn't the case that you can't make yourself smarter, but rather you tend not to make yourself smarter in a super general way. So if you learn French, let's say, that doesn't necessarily make you better at learning calculus or at learning soccer. Now, maybe in a really, really abstract high level way, in the sense that you're better at managing your time or you have more confidence, there's a few things like that. But in terms of all the specific work for learning French, that mostly helps you with learning French, maybe with Spanish and Latin and a few related languages in that kind of way. And so I think this sort of basic model that we have sort of general capacities, which are probably not amenable to training, or if they're amenable to training, it's a lot of training. It's like you've been doing this for three decades and then that makes your brain somewhat different. But at the same time, just sort of go back to what I said earlier, there is still all these things that we know reduce your mental performance. So just getting those up to those. So I think we want to be at kind of our peak operating capacity. And that means exercising. That means eating well. That means getting enough sleep. That means, you know, managing stress and emotions in your life. That means being able to focus. That means getting rid of distractions. So there's a huge list of things that we don't actually achieve, most of us, all the time. And so I think that is something worth working on. But I'm also more skeptical of the idea that, you know, you do a lot of Sudoku puzzles and then you're going to be really good at learning French, let's say.
Yeah. No, it does seem like it's a bit of a stretch. And, you know, I'm in two minds about it as well. But yeah. I think that there is something to be said about making sure that you're hitting all of the necessary things to make sure that you're optimal from sleep to food, et cetera. Yeah. I'm a huge meditator. And I can say without a doubt, now, whether or not it's truly made me smarter, that's a whole nother thing. But as far as me being optimal, now, for whatever intelligence that I can grab out of my, you know, tiny puny brain, doing that consistently makes me better at being me, makes me better at reading. I can focus longer at reading. My memory retention goes up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So whether or not it's truly making me smarter, I don't really care at this point because I prefer that to it reduces my stress. That's going to help me learn easier. It's going to help me perform better, you know? And so I find those things to be incredible. I've seen these things. Now, what about, I'm going to take you way off. I'm going to take you way off topic.
All right. Let's go way slightly, off topic.
Slightly to bring it back. Now you kind of like zoomed over, you gave a little quick flyby of things. What about microdosing? What about LSD? What about the idea between learning in the creative sense of there's this creative, you know, there are two types of, I mean, two types, ridiculous. There's a bunch. But
I don't, in terms of like nootropics, which is sort of kind of what you're talking about there, as well as microdosing and this kind of thing, basically just ingesting substances of various kinds to give you presumed a cognitive performance. This is not a topic that I'm an expert on. So this is just purely my own kind of personal opinions right now. But my personal sense of it is kind of twofold. So one, I have this kind of basic belief of overall brain optimality in the sense that imagine, you know, there was just a switch that you could flip in your brain and would just make it universally better. So it would just be better at everything, at all things, just by flipping that switch. Now, the question is, you know, given that we're kind of evolved beings and we've come into this world sort of designed in some way, why wasn't that switch flipped on in the first place? Like, why would you need to take some substance to flip on that switch? And so this generally gives me a lot more skepticism towards people who say, oh, you know, there was some small study that says if you take, you know, I don't know, piracetam or whatever, one of these like things, and then it improves cognitive performance. And my question is, but how would it give you just an only benefit, no trade-off? If it just gives you benefit, no trade-off, why wouldn't the brain have just been designed that way in the first place? So there are possible ways around that argument. So you could maybe argue that, well, when the brain is more active, perhaps it's consuming more calories. So we don't worry about calories in our modern society so much, but maybe your brain sort of going faster and that's why those switches aren't on. Or maybe there's some trade-offs that maybe would have mattered in our ancestral environment that we don't care about right now. So, you know, obviously the student who has to study all day maybe needs to focus, whereas being distractible was maybe more beneficial when you were, you know, sitting by the campfire millions of years ago. So I don't want to say they're knockdown arguments, but I tend to be somewhat on the side of substances. The only thing I would say about that, and I think that there could be a benefit of it, you were saying about creativity, is sometimes you want your brain to be constrained in some ways to prevent you from doing other things. So I'll use the context of doing drills, because I think this is a perfect example, is that let's say you are playing a soccer game, right? Now, you could just play soccer games your whole life, but if you did some specific shooting drills, you'd probably get better at shooting. And this isn't just because you'd have more time for shooting, but also because you would sort of in some ways be removing all the other aspects of the game that would normally you'd have to be keeping in your mind at the time.
Right.
And so I think there can be something said for, even if there are maybe some trade-offs so that you are maybe a little bit impaired in some ways, it may benefit you in other ways just because it forces you out of the kind of routines that you've sort of laid down and you have to do it in a new way. You have to do it in a new way. So I don't know. My sense is that from what I understand about, you know, psychedelics and things like that, that's sort of where it moves, is that it kind of it disrupts some of the normal patterns of processing that you have, which maybe will cause you to have new ideas. But it may also cause you to have more bad ideas too. So it's probably not the case that we'd all be better if we were just on acid all the time, but it may be the case that if you really needed something new and you didn't mind that you had more bad ideas, that might be helpful. Again, this is, you know, talk to your doctor before any,
you're 100% like, an expert. I don't know, you know everything.
Yeah, I'm
now, you know,
0% an expert, right? So don't listen to me.
Yeah. No, but that's fascinating. Yeah. Your take on it is valid for sure. And it just reminds me of, did you see that documentary on Netflix? The one about, is it Take Your Pills? Have you heard this one?
No, I haven't. I haven't. Sorry.
Well, that one is, it's all about Adderall and what's going on in society and how kids that are in school and trying to learn are taking all sorts of drugs, Ritalin and Adderall, et cetera, et cetera. And they had some really interesting studies on that that were also showing that which it's hard for me. I've never taken any of those things, so I personally don't know. But I believe they had the guy who essentially made whether it was Ritalin or one of these drugs, who made it famous or started prescribing it or something along these lines. And now what they had found after doing studies on people that were taking the drugs is that they were finding that it didn't improve your performance necessarily. And I'm clearly also not an expert and I'm probably botching this, but something of this is the truth is that they found that it didn't necessarily improve your performance by such a drastic nature, but it made you think that it did. So it was giving you the perception of this, like you're a genius. It was giving you this, it was a genius pill.
Well, I recommend reading the book Never Enough by, I can't remember the name, but she's a sort of an addictions researcher, but she writes it from a neuroscience perspective. So she's a neuroscientist who specializes in addiction. But it's a really fascinating chapter because she's also a former drug addict. And so she talks about her experiences doing drugs. And so now I don't recall whether she was ever taking amphetamines, so like Ritalin and these kind of things are amphetamines. Yeah. But in the book, but you know, they work on a kind of a similar mechanism to cocaine and other stimulants that they involve dopamine and these kinds of things. And so it's a really fascinating take from the book. So again, I'm also botching my sort of reading of this. I'm not an expert, but my understanding as well is that what is often happening when you're, you know, taking kind of substances that activate these kind of dopamine pathways is it's as if the switch in your brain that says this is important was like dialed up. So everything you're doing is like, this is important. And I think that also affects mood and it affects confidence and affects your energy. But that's sort of maybe part of the reason that something that just seemed really dull before seems, you know, okay, I'm into this right now. So I don't know. My like, I personally have not had any experience with, you know, other than caffeine with these kind of mental enhancing drugs. Like when I remember when I was doing the MIT challenge, a friend of mine who I'll remain nameless was saying to me, he's like, oh, man, I've got some extra Ritalin if you want some Ritalin. I'm like, no, man, that's fine. I don't need any Ritalin. And so I don't know. I don't want to say that as like to pat myself on the back because maybe I'm just set up in a way that I didn't find it was difficult to focus for that challenge. I mean, I had to put in a lot of work, but I found it generally interesting. And it was just a matter of making sure I had enough time to do it. And so that's something that I have talked to other people that they struggle with a lot. And so I don't know exactly what to recommend there other than just, I think your ability to persist on something is kind of also related to these complex motivational factors of whether or not you find it interesting, whether or not you feel like you're good at it, whether or not you feel like you're making progress and this kind of thing. And so I think these are subtle factors. And so even for myself, if something gets just over a certain difficulty threshold, well, then it's really hard for me to stick to it and focus. I mean, if it gets to something where it's like, oh, is this more effort than it's worth? So I think constructing the project and constructing your environment are so important for being able to do that. Although I don't know any magic cure for people who find themselves distractible, I think you can take sort of normal steps and improve your ability to focus quite a bit.
Yeah, no. And obviously that's the hardest thing about it, which kind of segues into one of the other things is that in trying to learn how to focus or to meditate, which is another good one, really anything that's difficult, but it's so easy at the beginning to want to just, when you fail, it's if you are not truly interested in this thing, or if you're not truly devoted to doing it, it's so easy for you to just walk away. And the thing that's really hard about it is that so many people, all of us have probably many things about us that we want to change, that we feel could be better, you know, whether that's, you know, in the way that we deal with relationships or to learning something. And so is his name James Clear that wrote the foreword to your book?
Yes, James Clear. Yeah.
So he, I didn't know who that was. He wrote Atomic Habits, right? Also.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he speaks about is these percentage, the trying to get better, obviously in a small, you know, almost infinitesimal way over the course of time will obviously add up to something that's truly quite interesting. And I met a Marine just recently, and we got to be pretty good friends. And I was asking him all about all sorts of stuff. How do they teach you stuff? Because I'd heard this, he didn't necessarily confirm or deny this, but that Air Force pilots, essentially when they go to learn, is that they're just basically like, all right, here's the throttle. This is the thing here. This is a sink or swim, or basically fly or crash. And essentially that their crash course is incredibly quick. And that the learning time for that is basically, this guy's either going to get it or he's not. And that is an aggressive learning style. I mean, I guess it kind of mirrors, you know, essentially what you're trying to say with, you know, with trying to learn a language, which is kind of, you need to be thrown in there. But, yeah. Now, once again, second time I'm going to lose where I was going because I have so much in my head. But yeah, I have no idea. Regardless, let me just touch on memory retention and things like that after you've learned and all the stuff that's going on. So how does one tackle? Because like you have so many different things. Do you go revisit? Do you have a program plan, or how is someone?
Yeah, like no, this a kid? This is also something that I've shifted my thoughts on. I would say over the years, because I think when I got started into doing this, my kind of informal assumption is, oh well, you know, the main thing is learning it, and then the maintenance is kind of whatever about, right? Like it's, and I think that's again part of my bias from the education system, because that's how we teach subjects in school. Is oh, you pass the exam, oh, you're done. All right, there you go.
It's done.
It's you're done. You're, now you know calculus. You're done. Now everyone knows that they don't know calculus, even though they took calculus and maybe even got a grade on it. You know, everyone knows that there's all these subjects that we learned from school that we've forgotten. But I think just the bias of our education system is just sort of like, well, what are you going to do, right? You know, you're going to forget things, whatever. And so I think that was sort of my attitude a little bit more toward the MIT challenge, especially because the way that challenge was structured, obviously learning it was so intensive in that time period. Didn't really have a lot of time to be like, okay, I'm also going to do the same class three or four times. Like that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
So I think after that challenge, I became more aware that this is actually a pervasive problem. And so when I did the language learning challenge, I was very aware that, okay, I'm going to be learning four different languages in a short period of time. You know, if I do nothing, I'm not going to be able to speak these 4 years later. And I don't want to say that you can get to a point where you forget nothing, where you're like just as perfect as you were before on zero amount of work. I don't want to give that impression. But I think the approach most people take when they're, you know, they're in some sort of intensive learning environment, then they leave it and they do nothing, is probably bad for a lot of skills. And I think especially skills like languages, where, you know, if you said you learned Spanish and then some Spanish person comes up and starts speaking in Spanish, you want to have it. You don't want to be like, wait, give me 2 weeks and then I'm going to read the book again. And you don't want to be like that. You want to just have it. And so what I did after that trip is I did for a year, I did once weekly for each language, a kind of tutoring session online. And this wasn't a tutoring session where they're like tutoring me. It was just like a conversation, but hiring tutors is just easy to guarantee that you have those time slots. And then the 2 years after that, I switched to once a month. And then since then, I've been doing it on a more sporadic basis. But then that's given me about maybe 5 years now, where I've had sort of semi-regular practice with each of these languages. Now, there's going to be stuff that you're going to forget, like the kind of ordering a restaurant dialogue doesn't get tested on Skype conversations as much. So those are some of the things you forget. You're like, oh yeah, what was that food I was eating 6 years ago? You forget it. But you still retain enough of the core vocabulary and structure, and you even learn some new things that you can still sort of be in a situation where, oh, I have to use this language, and you can turn it on. And so language learning is just one example of that. But I think the amount of work you need to do to maintain knowledge in the long run for most skills and subjects is not a lot, but it's also not zero. And zero is overwhelmingly what people do with a lot of these things. And then they, you know, and then they don't actually have those skills later when they need them.
Yeah, which sucks, because that's why you were studying it in the first place. So it could be there on call, or at least you would think so, you know. But to kind of move to something different and interesting, what about, and what do you think, I don't know if you know any of this, and I don't remember what it's called, I want to say that it's called the Neuralink, Elon Musk's,
his brain. I don't know that much about the Neuralink, so I won't comment on his specific thing. I think, you know, it's interesting. I'm not opposed to that kind of thing in principle, or at least like on scientific grounds. I don't know whether it's from humanitarian grounds is a great thing, but the idea that we can interface with technology directly with our brain, I don't think is impossible, but it's also something that I think there's a lot of hype right now with artificial intelligence, neuroscience generally, but I think there is this also, it kind of cuts both ways. There's the groups of people who think, oh, you know, we're a decade away from understanding how the brain works, to the people who think we don't understand anything about the brain when we actually understand a ton, like crazy detailed circuits of like how various things get processed in the brain. And so I think that there's probably some, there's probably going to be in the future something like this. I think, especially when you're getting into something that's like a medical device now, the regulatory hurdles itself may be a major impediment to scientific progress, because I don't want to be the first guy to test one of these things if it has to get like installed in my head. But at the same time, I think this really opens up a lot of possibilities. And I think, you know, there's a whole idea of what's called kind of like embodied cognition, which is the sense that when we are processing things with our minds, we're often using things that are outside of our brains. So if I'm doing a math problem on pencil and paper, I'm using the fact that I can store temporary work on the paper to solve the problem. So even though the paper is not a part of my brain, let's say, there is an argument to be made that it's part of my mind, at least temporarily, for this problem. And so I think this idea is very interesting. Even things like when people have like amputated limbs and they get, you know, new arms, and that they can control them with their nervous system, I think this is fascinating stuff. So I think the idea that we might, you know, you might just have a calculator that you can just, you know, just think, and you can just calculate numbers in your head, would be a cool thing to have. I don't know what you would use those kind of things for, but it would definitely be very interesting.
Yeah, I don't know what that, it's obviously very hard for us to try and understand what that sort of consciousness would actually feel like, to have an answer.
I mean, what does it feel like to solve a math problem on a piece of paper? I mean, there's lots of ways. It sounds really like mystical when you say something outside of your brain. But in a sense, we're always already doing this. It's just that we're normally doing it through the medium of our physical bodies. Whereas, you know, if you were to do something like this, it would be, you know, I think it would be the kind of thing that once they got it working, it would probably, you know, just the same way that if you had said like 30 years ago, the idea of like voice commands, just, it just sounds kind of strange to Siri and stuff. Yeah. And now it's just sort of an annoying thing that only works 80% of the time.
Yeah. It doesn't work quite as well as we hoped.
So I feel like the Neuralink in the future is going to be like the future Siri, the thing that like sounds really cool when you think about it, but then it's like, all right, I'm just going to do this with my hand on my cell phone. Right now.
Yeah. It's probably not going to work exactly how we feel like it is.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's a step. It's a weird thing, because I also have seen all sorts of pop up, and I know we've spoken a lot about language and I'm about to move off of it, but in seeing these apps and things that are, or even Skype now, I don't know if this works in other languages, but the subtitles are flawless. I don't know if have you ever tried this?
Subtitles on Skype? No, I haven't done it on Skype. I've seen them on YouTube, so I've seen them on like post-processed video, but I haven't seen them on live subtitles.
Yeah, live. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. That's what's shocking, because I'll sit there talking to somebody and we'll try and trick it. You know, we're just trying to make it, because it's really phenomenal. So, you know, I know we're getting to a point, and we will 100% get to a point where, if is language learning going to be useless? Are we all going to have that? Because if you're already plugged into the internet, then That's got,
you know, Google, I have a soft spot. Like, I have a soft spot for language learning because I really like language learning. So I would say from a societal perspective, I mean, yeah, I think even just the dominance of English as a kind of lingua franca, so to speak, has also made language learning other than English go down considerably, you know, because of the case that, well, you know, if you're doing something in kind of an international commerce or scientific or academic way, you're going to be doing it in English. So that's the one that you need to learn. And so that sort of, you know, your colleagues in Denmark being like, well, why do you want to learn Danish is sort of represents that a little bit. I don't quite agree with that, but I can see why people feel that way. And I think, yeah, machine translation is going to make that a lot easier. And so where it's going to break down are these kind of edge cases where you don't, you know, you're not able to translate things very well. The one thing I would say about that, though, and I don't want to say that this is going to be like the knockdown argument for why that won't work at a broad scale economically, because the fact is most people already rely on translation, whether it's done by a person or whether it's done by a machine, and we're kind of fine by that. But I think that the idea of that there's a lot of things that you can't really understand once you've translated them. And so I think that that is also the kind of the difficulty of translating between languages. There are just some things that get omitted when you translate it. It means that I think that there is going to be a place for language learning even in the future, but it may not be the kind of the dominant way that we communicate is through language learning.
Yeah, it's going to change. It's going to change in ways I think that we're not quite sure of yet. And I mean, maybe it's gonna be a hybrid version of things, or, you know, where people have an understanding of, or maybe if you have a better understanding of it without the tool or the Neuralink, you have some sort of benefit. I have absolutely no idea, you know. But I listened to this other podcast. One of my favorite podcasts is called Mysterious Universe, and they tend to talk a lot about tech. They talk a lot about consciousness, and then they'll go into paranormal things as well. It's a very wide range thing. So I'll throw this at you as well, because one of their great arguments and ideas is kind of a philosophical one they like to talk about. And it's, they have the sense that, so right now in our current paradigm, we have a general sense that obviously that the brain is the seat of consciousness, more or less the materialistic view of that the brain is what's processing and creating consciousness. So as to say, when your brain dead, essentially there's nothing going on. And how they like to view it and like to present things at is that the brain is actually more of a receiver or like an antenna, and that consciousness is perhaps outside, and that your brain is actually what it's doing is like a receiver on a radio or a TV back when they were like that, is that it's allowing you to focus. It's allowing you to focus into this reality, into this world, into this consciousness, you know? And so it's an interesting theory, obviously one that's almost nearly impossible to prove, or it's going to take us forever to try and figure something out like that, but one that's I find intriguing. So where would you find
yourself? Well, I'm definitely much more of a physicalist in my kind of overall worldview. So my gut reaction is to just dismiss things like that. But I would say that my personal feelings are that there is a lot that we don't understand about the brain. I don't think that it's going to turn out that there was some kind of extra physical stuff that was impacting kind of brain matter. And I think there's good reasons for thinking that there probably wouldn't be. So for instance, the fact that we kind of have in the range of like energies that are experienced in human life, we have kind of physics basically worked out. So there's an idea, there's still physics that we haven't worked out, but that only really has to do with like black holes and stuff moving near the speed of light and really, really high energies and temperatures and this kind of stuff. When we're talking about, you know, stuff that's kind of warm and squishy and lives on the earth, we've got the laws of physics basically figured out. And so that means that if there were some kind of extra sensory or extra kind of physical interaction with matter, you'd have a real big problem, because you'd have to sort of say, well, we know that, you know, the human body is made out of physical stuff and it's interacting. And if there's some antenna, there has to be some kind of causal relationship. So I think people who are arguing for that form of dualism have a real kind of hurdle to overcome, because they have to explain, well, like, how does it not work that way? But I think there are interesting sort of alternatives to what could be called kind of a very strictly, you know, let's call it a subjectivist view of the mind, where the mind is this kind of thing that's encased inside your skull, and that it like, you know, points at things outside the skull, which is sort of what we've inherited really from philosophy since Descartes, is this idea that, you know, there's this external world and an internal world, and they're related somehow, and how are they related? And so I think even if we sort of can't really like, can't really get around the idea that, you know, even if there's, you know, I mentioned right now the fact that when I'm solving a math problem on a paper, in a certain sense, what is being performed by my mind is not entirely in my brain. It's maybe also in my hands or on the paper, but that's not really something wooey. It's not really mystical. It's just something that we kind of take for granted. And so I think there's probably alternative conceptions of how we view what the mind is, that maybe, you know, don't have such hard boundaries around our brain, that maybe the mind also includes things like, you know, cultural artifacts and technology and symbols and even things like, you know, where does language exist? Well, it's clearly not just in my brain or your brain, but it's not really any place in space either and stuff. So I think there's still room for philosophy to answer these questions. But I think when we're getting to the question of like, well, what do you do with that information? I think if we're thinking, okay, well, I can like pick up thoughts from other people using some kind of physical force, that that's probably ruled out right now, unless you're imagining some major upset to a current understanding of physics.
Yeah, I find it all incredibly fascinating, even with them and these things being outliers and stuff like that. There's a Dean Radin, I actually find, who gets smashed, you know, completely crushed. He is, I want to say, he's a Princeton professor. Once again, I should know this, right? Like, if I imagined this guy like listening to me trying to describe what he is, he's the head of noetic sciences, which they tend to study a whole bunch of consciousness and all sorts of things. Yeah. So what I like to see from them is this push towards things that are on the fringe edge of physics that physics hasn't, you know, and I do like seeing them push back up against the general consensus of physics, because it does change. Things do change, you know, in that sense, as far as our general understanding. Now, whether or not it's going to come in and say, well, great, this doesn't equal this at all. No, I don't expect that. I don't expect to see anything like that at all, but I do really enjoy those conversations.
If I were to like make my personal predictions about where you might see our kind of understanding shift in the future. And I mean, it's really impossible to say that because I'm basing it on what our current understanding is. But if I were to make predictions about where is the ground soft and where is it hard, I don't think it would be with physics, just because the way that we've kind of studied it, something really crazy would have to be happening for that not to be, for that ground is pretty hard. But I think where there is a lot more kind of flexibility, I guess you could say, is that we've made sort of a lot of arbitrary conventions about, you know, like, as I said, just this idea that, well, you know, even just this preeminence of consciousness, even the idea that consciousness is really what's important, is also kind of a little bit of an inheritance from this idea from Descartes, this kind of idea that I am this self-sufficient subject that's sort of separate from the world. And so I think this is probably where there's more room to shift around and where there's more room to rethink things and to rethink, you know, what's important and what things need to be included in order to understand kind of what the mind's doing or what, you know, what our minds are doing when we're having this conversation or, you know, what society's doing at that level. I think there's probably ways that those concepts could get moved around in ways that, you know, don't really reflect how they're currently being underpinned. But I don't think that what we're going to come to as an understanding is going to be that there's some completely new physics that we just missed right now that only matters.
How cool would that be, though? Yeah. I want there to be, you know, I don't know where as far as aliens, you know, we're going to take the podcast all the way to aliens there. It seems now, I honestly, I don't know what, I have no idea. Yeah. Clearly, obviously, I have no idea. Wouldn't it just suck if we were the only thing?
That seems pretty unlikely, though, right? You know,
doesn't like, it? It just.
But don't doesn't it like you'd have to believe that, like, that's kind of crazy to believe in and of itself, right?
100%,
that there's no other aliens. Now, whether there's aliens that are close enough for us to ever be in kind of causal contact with is kind of an open question. But given how big the universe is, the idea that there's literally nothing else out there, that if we had the ability to go and look, that we would find nothing. But it may actually turn out, because space is really big, it may turn out that there are other civilizations or aliens or this kind of thing, and just they just don't matter because they're so far away that we can't ever talk to them or anything. That's kind of a boring possibility, but I mean that seems to me the more believable option than the idea that like literally nothing for you know hundreds of billions of galaxies. That seems pretty far-fetched.
Yeah, it seems to be way out there. And I mean,
well, even planets, like we recently found, like, you know, in my lifetime, they've discovered all these planets around, you know, extra solar star systems.
What do you call that? Right.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think that this is just really a problem that like stuff's really far away. It's really hard to look at it. We just actually don't know what's out there because we can only really look at like the, you know, even the things that are super, super big. And just, you know, they're just specks of light really far away. Yeah. So it's very hard to see anything up close. And we're certainly not in a position to build a spaceship to go get there. So, I mean, but I think there probably is something out there. I just don't know whether it's something that's relevant to us. But
right. Well, then, I mean, obviously that then would take you theoretically into the, if that is the case, I would love to think, and was it Michio Kaku, who was the great physicist, right? Is he a Japanese American? Sure. Maybe Japanese. You don't know Michio Kaku?
I think I maybe know who he is, but I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah. He's one of those guys like Neil deGrasse Tyson. Like they'll just be like,
yeah,
believe everything that this guy says because he's way smarter than you. Like, and they'll put him in clips and like that.
Yeah.
And they're
I think I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I remember him giving a speech, at least, et cetera, about the idea of it's not only how big the universe is, it's also how old it is at that. Yeah. You know, at that point too, which is we've got to wonder, well, if it's possible. I mean, I believe the universe is 13 point something billion years old. I would
but
love
I mean,
to.
At the same time, you know? At the same time, like life on Earth is like 4 or 5 billion years, and multicellular life is about a billion years. So, I mean, I don't really know the whole cosmology of it. My understanding of it was that galaxies were forming, you know, less than a billion years after the Big Bang. And so in that case, it seems like there'd be plenty of time for there to have been, you know, it doesn't seem like it's more likely that we were the first, like that there was just, it was impossible to do it any faster than we did it. You know, and you'd imagine as well that there's some kind of, you could say kind of a stochastic process that's generating life because you just have to get things in the right configuration so that they can start replicating and do that kind of thing. And so that would also assume that if it's happening in lots of places, that there'd be a big range. And so there's no reason to assume that you would be the first to be generated. Right. But you know, there's a really good idea. I don't know if you know Robin Hanson's The Great Filter, which is kind of reflecting this, what's basically known as the Fermi paradox, whereas we look in the sky and we don't see anything, see any obvious signs of like, you know, major intergalactic civilizations. And so the question is why? And so the idea of a great filter is that there is some stage between no life and there being some intergalactic civilization that's so obvious that you can see it from any part of, you know, the galaxy or whatever, that there's some filter that prevents you from going further than that. And you can use kind of a little bit of anthropic reasoning to get the answer that, well, it's far more likely that the filter is ahead of us than behind us. So there's something that's going to prevent us from becoming that kind of civilization. And rather than we were just really lucky in getting this far. So that's sort of an interesting argument. I don't know whether it's true, but.
Yeah, we've basically solved the alien issue there. So if anybody.
Guys. Yeah.
It's a, obviously a very fascinating thing to think about. I mean, I'll throw this at you. This is our last thing before we get you out of here. What about, given the, based on your understanding of what you would think, whether consciousness is or just life in general, just the ability to live and as you are and as you are living right now, do you think we will be at a point where we will be able to, and I know this is a huge AI question as well, upload a version of Scott who is going to be able to live somewhere else without an understanding that he is. So whether that's in a computer, whether that's in a simulation, or even if it's not a computer, we use computers now, obviously, to equate how we look, because that's our best metaphor. But Do you think we'll be able to do that?
So, there's a lot of stuff because a lot of people like this. You're thinking of the Bostrom argument, the simulation argument that like, well, if you imagine that we one day will have lots of computers and then the computers will be able to run simulations of society, then you can imagine that there will be more simulations at sort of, there'll be more simulations at the level kind of below than where we are right now. So therefore you should reason that, you know, we're more likely to be in a simulation than not. I didn't read his full argument in his book, so I may be just reading kind of the badly articulated versions of this idea. I kind of think this idea is sort of nonsense. It's kind of nonsense in the same way that like the brain in the vat idea is kind of nonsense. Or there's also this, I think it's called the Boltzmann brain problem from physics, which is like, in quantum mechanics, for instance, there's always a low probability of things making a certain configuration for a vanishingly small period of time. And so the question is, you know, why are you not just, why do you think there's a whole universe? Wasn't it more probable that like maybe your just brain just spontaneously came into existence for like half a second? And Sean Carroll has this idea that that sort of argument is, well, you can't argue that it's not possible. You can argue why it's not, I forget the word he was saying, it's not like cognitively consistent, meaning that if you were even in that situation, you'd have no reason for believing you were in that situation. So it's,
I see.
Even if that's actually true, there's no reason to believe in it. And so I don't know whether this applies to this simulation argument, but I suspect there's some sort of similar kind of sleight of hand going on here that you're kind of making all these assumptions about what's going to happen. And then therefore we're in this situation. And I don't know, my feeling is that I think that it's possible that we might get to a point where artificial intelligence or kind of human mind uploads and this kind of things. I don't think there's a physical reason it can't happen, but I do think that the kind of current way things artificial intelligence are going makes people think that it's a lot closer than it probably is. And that I think that there's a lot that we don't really even understand about how, you know, how the brain has to work in with things to really get that kind of figured out. So my feeling is that if there is something like that happening, I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime. So I'm not sure whether I make any predictions about it.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I also don't know if I would want that. And yeah, clearly I would continue and go into the fact that now all we're trying to do as well is trying to fight aging. We're trying to decide if aging is a disease, and then we're going to try and live for God knows how long. Well, how long? What if we could live for long? How long is too long? Is there a place? Is there a moral place? Are 500-year-olds, should they be able to hang out with 100-year-olds and get married to 100-year-olds? How smart are you at 500? How much do you know about the world?
I'd be okay with like 120. I would be happy with that. If they give me that pill, you know.
When you can walk, right? Though when you can walk and you can use everything and do well.
Yeah, it's been really fascinating talking about all these topics of which I have no expertise. So anyone listening here now, it needs like a big disclaimer here that like at about halfway through the podcast.
That's the way the podcast is. That's the way it is.
I refuse. Yeah.
No, yeah. You know, I enjoy just having discussions on all those things. It's really great in general. Yeah. And people are going to obviously find everything that you've said about learning and not just that, just your general ideas, incredibly, incredibly interesting. So where can they find everything and anything they want to about Scott Young?
Website at scotthyoung.com. I've got thousands of articles there about learning, self-improvement, habits, a lot of things we were talking about, at least in the earlier part of the podcast. Not so much about aliens and trans psychic experiences. And then also my book, Ultra Learning, if you're interested in learning more effectively, whether that's for sports or whether that's for anything that you want to do well. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you get your books. It's also available on Audible as a download, and I'm narrating it. So if you're not sick of me talking right now, you can listen to me for another several hours when I read you the book.
Obviously, it's great. And we're going to cut up, obviously, the points that are very pertinent to guys that are trying to learn. We'll make sure we'll put those out on the channel, guys. So make sure to go check out Scott. Scott, thanks for coming. We will link everything into the show notes or down below, obviously, if this is on YouTube. So once again, that's the podcast. Thanks for coming, man.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Later.